This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, the independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the independent republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. And so, it looks like I was right once again. It gets a bit boring, this, doesn't it? I keep being right all the time. It's almost impossible to predict when I could possibly ever get anything wrong. The newspapers this morning are already talking about a faster path to freedom if the number of vaccinations exceeds expectations, which they are almost certainly bound to do. What did I tell you yesterday? Much to the chagrin of some of you, I was welcoming the roadmap to recovery set out by Boris Johnson because I said it was a step in the right direction. Some of you were dismissive because it wasn't going fast enough. Some of you were saying things like, Mike, how can you possibly ever betray us like this? Why are you not giving the Prime Minister a harder time? Well, I said the reason I wasn't doing that was because I actually firmly believe that this was the way out of this problem. And it might not look great at the moment. It might not look brilliant. It might not be everything you ever actually asked for. But we are indeed going somewhere where we want to end up. Now it looks exactly like that will happen, and probably sooner than you thought. This morning, we will be celebrating with Tory MP Deanna Davidson, plotting a day when the pubs will reopen, and she'll be telling us about a bill as well that she's pushing through Parliament to do with the one-punch law, which tragically affected her father himself. 0344 499 1000. Coming up later on, we'll be speaking to Neil Oliver about the dreadful state of democracy in Scotland, where yesterday, and you'll have to pay attention to this, the former First Minister, Alex Salmond, had documents withdrawn from the submission to a parliamentary committee, and the current First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, asserted that he should make it all clear when he appears before that very same committee, which he now says he won't be doing, after first saying that he wouldn't do it, then saying that he would, now saying again that he won't. Again. Also, we'll be catching up with Simon Calder, travel guru with The Independent, who will tell us why so many people are booking foreign holidays without knowing if they'll actually be able to go. 0344 499 1000. Westminster is back, of course, so we'll be visiting Prime Minister's questions in the company of Charlotte Ivers, our political correspondent. Captain Hindsight hasn't said anything for a couple of days, so we can look forward to Sir Keir reminding the Prime Minister what he should have done and when he should have done it. Plus, I'll be telling you why the BBC is paying someone to teach their employees how to drink water properly, for heaven's sake. Absolutely unbelievable. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, I should tell you that this afternoon, this very afternoon, we'll be filming the second head-to-head debate. The first one between Peter Hitchens and Dan Hodges was a massive, roaring success with over 300,000 people watching it. And it was, of course, all about the lockdown rules, when the lockdown should be lifted. Today, we've got Toby Young from the Free Speech Union and Christopher Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs, both of whom have very different opinions about the lockdown, both of whom will be putting their cases, both of whom, I'm sure, will be very, very polite in the way that they dismiss each other's arguments. Let's talk now, though, to Deanna Davidson, Conservative MP for Bishop Auckland, one of the new Tory MPs who got in December, a woman who has previously been on this show and somebody who I think we can say with a reasonable amount of accuracy is a very sensible young MP. Deanna, a very good morning to you.
Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks for the very warm introduction there.
Listen, I'm all in favour of new MPs because the reason I like new MPs is because you've got an opportunity to kind of change the way things are done. You've got an opportunity to not be part of the furniture, and you have made quite a splash for yourself, I would say, in the first few months that you've been in. Tell us first of all. I know you've got a bill that you want to talk about, which we'll get to in a minute. But tell us first of all about the Boris plan, how you feel about it, what your constituents feel about it, and whether you agree with me that actually it might even get speeded up.
Well, I think, you know, I've seen a few newspapers report it as the Goldilocks plan. And I think that's probably a pretty accurate, accurate representation there. You know, the last thing we want to do is go too quickly and face another lockdown. I don't think that would be good for anyone, for anyone's business, for health, but also for mental health. And also, we don't want to go too slowly because, frankly, we want to get the economy opened up as quickly as possible and get life back to normal as quick as we can. So I think the very careful approach announced by the Prime Minister is the right approach. I think it's right that we have that sort of staggering in between so that we can see the actual tangible impacts of each stage of the unlock before we move on to the next stage. Would I like to see it speeded up if the cases and vaccination rates are going in the right direction? Of course I would. Like anyone else, I want to get back to normal as soon as we possibly can. But I do think the Prime Minister is right in the sense that it has to be data driven.
Yes. I mean, I think two things which have come up in the last couple of days that people have questioned, as far as I'm concerned, is one, have the government now finally accepted that hospitality does have to be part of the plan, and hospitality can't be left behind because there are so many people dependent upon it as an employer, also so many people dependent upon it for making a living and for being able to actually to live. But secondly as well, the other thing which people are annoyed about, it seems to me, is this kind of instruction to schools that kids are going to have to go back to school and they're going to have to wear masks for the whole period of time that they're there. So literally 7 to 8 hours a day.
Well, I think your point on hospitality is really valid. And certainly I've been fighting for the hospitality sector right since the lockdown hit back in March last year. I worked in hospitality for a number of years, as kind of so many young people do in those first couple of jobs, and recognise, you know, just how valuable it is for our economy, but also for our local communities. So certainly, you know, I think there is a recognition of how important the sector is. And I'm certainly hoping in the budget next week to see that support extended for the hospitality and leisure sectors, just to make sure they're able to get through this final bit of lockdown so that by the time they reopen, you know, they can reopen with a bang and really get their businesses fully back on their feet. Your question there about masks for children in school. I mean, obviously, this is a recommendation that's been made based on the scientific evidence to reduce any risk of kind of transmission between children. Now, we know that schools are safe. We know that children are very likely, very unlikely, I should say, to have any real kind of serious health issues if they are unlucky enough to contract coronavirus. But I'm not sure there's anything particularly wrong with an additional level of protection, but I can understand why some parents are perhaps a little bit uneasy with the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, I think, for a lot of parents is, you know, we want to try and normalise life for as much of us as possible, particularly for our children. And if they're going to be going back to school, but they're going to have to sit there with masks on continually for the whole day, it's not going to be helpful to them at all. And I've certainly had a lot of women and men calling me to say, look, we're not going to send our kids back. We're going to wait till after the Easter holidays and we're just not going to do it. And I'm not quite sure where that leaves them in terms of any kind of, you know, legal requirement.
Well, one of the things that is being investigated at the moment, Mike, is whether or not the vaccination is kind of suitable for children. I mean, obviously, at the moment, we are prioritising the people who are most at risk, which is why we started with the most vulnerable and the sort of elderly. But there are trials going on at the moment to see what the impact of the vaccine is on children, both in terms of, you know, them kind of contracting the virus, but mainly in terms of transmission. So that's something that's going on in the hope that, you know, we can offer the maximum protection to everyone right across our society. And that could maybe be something that could help reduce any need for masks in the classroom.
Yes, well, let's hope so. Let's talk a little bit about your investigation that's going on, because your father tragically was killed by one punch which somebody inflicted upon him 14 years ago. You're now trying to set up an all-party committee to look into it. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, when I was 13, my dad received one blow to the head in a pub and died instantly. And you can imagine the sort of impact that had on my life and the life of my family. And it kind of really has driven me to want to do something about it, to kind of stop those horrific events from happening to other families, but also make sure that they're getting the justice and the support that they need. So as of yesterday, I set up and launched the all-party parliamentary group for One Punch Assaults, with the intention of holding a really widespread investigation into everything around One Punch Assaults, looking at sentencing, looking at the support that victims and their families receive, looking at education and how best we can go and kind of show people that raising your fist isn't the answer. So we're going to be kicking off that investigation next week. We want to talk to victims who've been left with life-changing injuries. We want to talk to the families of victims who sadly passed away from these assaults. Judges, lawyers, police officers, but Also, we're keen to talk to perpetrators as well to get their reflections on how they feel they were treated by the criminal justice system.
Yes, I was going to ask you, what happened to the assailant in your father's case? Where did he go? How long did he go away for?
He was acquitted, actually, which was really? very difficult for my family to come to terms with.
Right. And what grounds was he acquitted then?
So he claimed self-defence. Right. There were contradictory witness reports, but it being a manslaughter trial, the burden of proof is obviously incredibly high. Mm. So the jury couldn't, believe beyond reasonable doubt that that wasn't the case. And
that's awful, isn't it? I mean, that must have been terrible for you.
It was really difficult, not just in the sense of, the fact that we'd had the shocking loss of Dad and we were trying to, get over the grief of that, but then to kind of have his character called into question in such a way as well. I mean, my dad was not a violent man in any way, shape or form.
No. And I mean, it does. Maybe you personally haven't, but I mean, as a man, you are in those situations quite often where you think, should I actually bother with this? I remember being in a situation once where I was coming out of a dry cleaners, believe it or not, at 10 o'clock in the morning in South London one day. And a guy came up behind me on a bike and rang his bell on the pavement. And I turned around and said, why don't you get in the bloody road or something like that, right? And he basically got off the bike and was sort of squaring up to me. And I thought to myself, this is mad. This is actually ridiculous. Mm-hmm. He could suddenly throw a punch at me or we could get into a fight over literally nothing. And, I just think that there's an awful lot more of this going on than probably we know.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that we're a little bit concerned about is in terms of one punch assaults, that we kind of don't have any specific figures for how many have happened over recent years. I mean, we have an idea from some charities and support groups that have been set up. But because of the way in which they're reported, there's kind of no official data on them, which makes it quite difficult to judge the scale of the problem, which is one of the things we do want to look into in our inquiry. But the point you just said there about, the experience you had outside of dry cleaners, which is nuts, is part of the reason we want to run this kind of longer term plan around education as well. Again, just to try and get out to young people, to young offenders institutions, whatever it might be, and share the stories of people who have lost family members to this. So yes. I'm doing some work with One Punch Northeast, and Maxine there lost her own son to a one punch assault, and she goes out into schools as a kind of inspirational speaker, I guess, and shares the story, and has had a lot of young people coming up to her afterwards and sort of saying, I always went towards, getting in a fist fight or whatever, but you've really made me think.
Yeah. So, because I think there is definitely, there's definitely a sector of society which sees violence as a very ordinary day-to-day sort of occurrence. They don't see that it's wrong or indeed that it's unusual for there to be a fight going on in the street or in the back garden or inside the house or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, and it's going to come down to education, really. So that's one of our missions, and we're trying to be quite creative with how we do that. So one of the ideas we discussed yesterday at our inaugural meeting was about getting in touch with soap opera companies and seeing if they might be willing to run a storyline around one punch assaults to show that, it's not always really heavy violence that results in serious injury or death. It can be a very split second decision to throw that one punch that can actually result in really catastrophic impacts.
Sure. Let's talk just a little bit before I let you go, Deanna, about the whole parliamentary experience for you, because you were elected in December 2019. You haven't really been there much since then. So what's it been like?
It has been a journey, Mike. We were just sort of starting to settle in when the pandemic hit. Mm. So it was a really strange experience, kind of, being shipped back off to our constituencies and having a mailbag that, had gone from full anyway to absolutely bursting at the seams. But it really is the most incredible job. I mean, you're able to do so much good for so many people. I love speaking to my constituents, surgery appointments, knowing that I can actually do things to make their lives better, which, in the grand scheme of things might seem like really small actions, but to them, it's things that mean the absolute world. But you're right, we haven't spent a great deal of time in Parliament. So I reckon, when Parliament is back fully, it's probably going to be like, starting fresh and having to do sort of refresher courses and relearn everything.
Yeah, exactly right. And what are you finding from your constituents about what they say about Boris? Because obviously up until the vaccine rollout, which was such a success and still continues to be such a success, and aside from Brexit, a lot of people have expressed a bit of disappointment about how he's kind of stewarded the entire economy and stewarded the recovery from COVID-19. Many people I've seen saying, we'll never vote Tory again. We gave them our vote, but we're not going to do it next time. Are you worried about that?
I mean, it's always a concern if someone who put their faith in you is kind of, you know, shaking and potentially changing their minds. But I'd say the main message I'm getting from my constituents, you know, they may be disappointed with an element of the lockdown or an element of the pandemic that's impacted their lives. But for the most part, what I hear from them is, you know, I wouldn't want Boris's job. I wouldn't want to have that pressure and those decisions. And they recognize how difficult a situation the Prime Minister and the whole cabinet are in to try and steer us through something that is kind of unprecedented in modern times. Mm. And that, you know, up until kind of recently, we were still learning so much about how the virus spreads, about its impact on people. Obviously, we've still got new variants. It's such a fast evolving situation where, you know, it's very difficult to ensure that everyone kind of wins, you know. Yeah. So I think that's probably the key thing, that people have sympathy with the Prime Minister for the really difficult decisions he's having to make.
Sure. Well, I've been promising people since yesterday that around about March the 17th, very possibly, or even maybe earlier, I'm going to be standing somewhere near Borough Market with a pint of beer in my hand, having bought it from one of the hostelries there. Given that we're seeing in the Telegraph today that there might be a speeding up of that recovery plan, do you think that's possible?
Hard to say at the moment, Mike. As I say, it all has to be driven around the data. And I kind of don't really want to speculate too much and give people a false sense of hope. But certainly, like you, I'm looking forward to that first takeaway pint as soon as we're allowed to have one.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, excellent. Well, hopefully the weather will improve. The sky will be blue. We'll be standing there at some point or other, possibly the same place, having the same amount of drink together. Deanna, thank you very much indeed. Deanna Davidson there, Conservative MP for Bishop Auckland, talking not only about her new One Punch committee, which is going on, but also about the fact that, you know, this recovery will actually, I think, happen a lot quicker, as I said yesterday, than we think that it will happen, because there is now a very good opportunity for people to look at the sales of businesses that are going on, to look at the number of vaccinations that are going on, to look at the falling of the rates of the infection that are going on. And I think there's only one conclusion that you could then come to, which is time to open up the economy.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, it is that time of the week when we check in with our travel guru, Mr. Simon Calder, a man who knows everything there is to know about the travel business, whether or not you can go anywhere, when you can go, how you can get there, and whether they will ask you for anything when you arrive. Of course, this morning, The Times has got a story saying Greece considers opening borders to Britain as early as May, apparently flying in the face of EU travel restrictions, in which they say they'd like to see all EU nations operating as one. However, Greece apparently is a bit more desperate for the old petrodollar than anybody else. Let's find out from Simon what's going on. Simon, very good morning to you.
Mike, yes, it is an extraordinary turn of events, and I think we're going to see it actually unfolding very much as we did last year. Mm. If you remember then, the European Union said, right, everybody, we want you to start opening your borders on the 15th of June and be fully open to everybody on the 1st of July.
Yeah.
And exactly as you say, lots of countries, particularly those in the Mediterranean with very tourism dependent economies, said you're having a laugh, Brussels. So, for instance, Croatia, basically, you know, from May onwards, was saying, Mike, come over here. Mm. Greece actually was a little bit slower with the Brits because we were having a few problems, but they eventually opened up. And it is going to be, as we've seen all the way through, every country for itself.
Right.
And all I would do is caution you a little bit to think that, I mean, obviously you're decades away from getting your COVID jab.
Well, do you know what? But I keep seeing friends of mine who are younger than me saying, oh, I've got my vaccination update and I'm going to go and get mine next week. And I still haven't had one.
No, well, a young man like you, they clearly have other issues or something.
Well, they obviously think that I'm superhuman and I'm probably immune or something like that, you know.
Yeah, but just suppose you got your first one on the 1st of March, and then you get your last one, what, back end of May, your free refill. Then you'd be kind of good to go from the point of view of many countries. And they're already doing this. Estonia, Georgia, Romania. Oh, Mike, yeah, we don't mind. Sputnik V, that's absolutely fine. Come on down.
Right. But what about those poor individuals who are so young that they're never going to be reached before that period of time and then want to go on holiday but somehow find themselves unable to go?
Yes, you're talking about the Talk Radio production team, I
exactly.
imagine.
Yes.
Yes. Well, they'll be fine too, because I tell you what, all this nonsense that Greece is talking. Look, I love Greece. It's a fantastic place. I can't wait to go back there. But they're kind of talking out of two sides of their mouth at the same time. They're saying, oldies, you've had your jabs, in you come. Mm. But they're also saying, families, come here. Don't worry about all that vaccine passport nonsense. Yeah. So typically,
the other question. I mean, a lot of people, and I would be included in this, have children who they want to take with them on holiday, regardless of the fact that I'd quite like to go without them sometimes. I have to drag them along. What happens if they haven't had one, for example? I mean, are they going to say, well, that's great because you and your mother, you know, the kid's mother have had it, but the kids haven't?
No, it's not going to be like that at all, of course. There may be kind of complete exemptions for children, which would be, I'm not sure how you would defend that on a kind of public health grounds. Mm. And obviously all of this is just about finding a balance between we want to open up to tourism so that we can rescue what's left of our economy. Mm. And we've got to protect our people. So every country is going to come up with a different balance. I mean, Greece is talking a great game. They're making sure everyone's talking about it in a way that people aren't talking about Spain or Portugal or Italy or Turkey. So what they will say is, right, Mike, we see you've got these annoying teenagers. Sorry, I'm sure they're absolutely lovely people. But
they used to be. They've suddenly got a lot more annoying recently.
And so what they're going to have to do is get a test before they come in, or maybe one on arrival. And you can just say, right, well, you know, get yourselves a cab. I'll be sitting at the taverna dangling my feet in the water with a Mythos beer. Thank you.
Absolutely.
So you will be able to go in. It will just be lighter touch.
Yeah. Now you're talking. And what about the return? Because one of my problems as an individual, I'm sorry to focus on myself here, but I mean, if I go to Greece in May or indeed June, when I come back, what do we know about the quarantine situation here?
Well, we know that the restrictions on travel, Mike, are going to get worse before they get better.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely. Snuck out on, I think, page 29 of that great long document about reopening, the roadmap to recovery was, oh, by the way, 8th of March, if anybody thinking of going abroad, clearly only for essential purposes, you've got to fill out a new declaration to travel, explaining why you are allowed to do that. The airlines, the ferry companies, the train operators will get fined if they let you out and you don't have a decent reason. I've talked to the Home Office, to the Department for Transport. They couldn't tell me any more about what it would involve. I've talked to transport operators and they say they haven't got a clue, but that's coming along too. And that'll be just yet one more hurdle. Yeah. But I mean, the main problems are obviously, will the country let you in? And we'll see about that. But certainly the Mediterranean nations, I think, will be delighted to see the Brits. You know, here we are. As you've been reporting, way ahead of every other country, we're going to go from kind of that sick man of Europe to everybody's favourite nationality overnight, should think.
Amazing.
Well, we hope so. Now, but you've then got to, as you say, get back into the UK, and that involves a test within 72 hours of leaving. Two more tests that you have to buy through the government for £210. So you're already up
per
to
head.
300 smackers, yeah, per Blimey. Person. And then if you have the misfortune to come back from, say, Portugal, you're also going to be in under house arrest in the Novotel at Heathrow.
Right.
So those are not conditions, I think, that are conducive to the Mike Graham family holiday, are they?
They're really not. I mean, this is the trouble, isn't it? Because you think about all of that and you think, really? Do I really want to put myself through this? Do I really want to spend that much money on getting tested? Do I really want to shove something up my nose repeatedly for the rest of the holiday? And do I have to also wear a bleeding mask from the moment I enter the airport to the moment I leave the other airport?
Well, I mean, certainly that last point you almost certainly will. It's uncomfortable. But the worst experience I've had was actually on a very heavily delayed train, which was supposed to just go to York, normally 2 hours from London. And this, I think, was 5 hours. Oy. And that was fairly uncomfortable.
I bet.
But the understanding in the travel industry, and of course, all of this is hedged by the government. They say won't be any earlier than the 17th of May that you can go abroad. It won't necessarily be on that date, but it certainly won't be any earlier. So it's all very, very heavily hedged.
Yeah.
But the airlines, the holiday companies know that if the government is serious about restarting travel, then they're going to have to get rid of those restrictions from all the kind of key countries. And there might be the odd one. It might be that Portugal's still having real problems and that stays on the no-go list. But yeah. Spain's okay, Croatia's okay,
Greece is okay. I still think, Simon, I don't know about you, but I mean, I still think there's going to have to be at some point a brave decision made by politicians of every hue and in every country that they go, look, we can't carry on like this. You know, we need the tourism business back. It's a massive business. It creates massive amounts of revenue for the government. It creates massive amounts of jobs. And we can't just continue to ban people from various different countries and stop people from going anywhere.
Mike, you say that, but then have a listen to Nicola Sturgeon. Scotland, she of course is the First Minister.
I mean, we'll be talking about that coming up a bit later on in the show.
Right, you know, okay.
She's on what they call it in Scotland, a sugarly peg.
Right, well, they say lots of things in Scotland, but what they particularly say about tourism is that we're not even going to think about opening up till the back end of April.
Right.
She's already warned, you know, don't plan your summer holidays. We might be able to stay in Scotland. But they very, very, very much have this idea that, no, you've got to keep people out. That's the only thing you can do. And I didn't say that, crikey. Their tolerance of risk, not their tolerance of you, their tolerance of risk is low, it appears to be very low.
Yeah.
I think other countries will have a much higher tolerance of risk because they desperately need to rescue their tourism industry. And you would have thought that maybe Scotland would, given that it is such, you know, it's much more crucial tourism to Scotland than it is to England. Tourism for Wales also very, very important, yeah. Which is why the First Minister there, Mark Drakeford, and I will choose my words very carefully because not everybody in Wales loves me, I've noticed.
Well, not everybody in Wales loves Mark Drakeford either, I can tell you.
Mark Drakeford has said that he is hopeful of opening self-contained accommodation in time for Easter.
Right.
Now, there's going to be a review. We simply don't know what's going to happen. We're obviously how many weeks away, sort of 5 weeks away from then. But that might happen, in which case it would clearly be of benefit maybe to people. Well, I think people in Wales would be able to take advantage of that. People in England wouldn't because we'll still have the ban on staying overnight.
Yes. Well, they've always had a bit of an interesting relationship, haven't they, Scotland and Wales, with people travelling in and out of their country. I always remember, I think they've done away with it now, but the old Severn Crossing used to only be chargeable as you went into Wales, and as you were leaving, it was free. So you were free to go, but you had to pay to get in.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right. It's a beautiful, beautiful country.
It is. I love it very, very much. I'm both, in fact, as far as Scotland goes, I'm actually technically Scottish, so I'm required to go to Scotland quite regularly to go and visit the birthplace of my ancestors and also to visit several of my friends. But here's the other thing, right? The idea that Scotland can live without tourism is a complete nonsense because basically it's their biggest industry. You know, take aside oil and gas and whiskey. Tourism is what makes Scotland tick.
Yeah, I think they are taking the view that they've done pretty well. You know, they'd say they've done better than the rest of the UK.
Yeah, but they'd be wrong about that, wouldn't they?
That they want to keep it that way, and therefore, because they know, and I'm not getting into politics here, I'm just reading what it says about the financial settlement, because they believe that they will get effectively compensated for losses from tourism, they say, no, we're going to keep the borders shut in a way that, of course, they're perfectly entitled to do, as is Wales. And I mean, we saw last summer for quite a time, if you were in Wales, you could travel around and stay overnight in Wales. If you were outside Wales, you couldn't go in. Mm. And that's entirely up to every country.
Yes. And what's the status of America? I'll ask that again entirely selfishly, because obviously my mother is getting on a bit. She's going to be 97 on March the 29th.
Crikey.
I'd very much like to go and see her. She's had two vaccines now, and she's in good order. And I'm hoping, and she keeps saying, when are you coming? And I keep saying, well, I don't know. I can't tell you. But I mean, what do you reckon about the American situation?
Okay, well, look, so a couple of things. You are in the category, and there's a lot of people in this, Mike, that you would know, of people who have really pressing family reasons for needing to travel. And so, therefore, you know, you should have absolutely a fast pass to get there. I think those will be the people who initially will be allowed to travel. Bear in mind that it's been illegal for almost a year for anybody from the UK to go to the US, as you will know full well.
Yeah.
It was lifted for about 10 minutes by Donald Trump, and then Joe Biden put it in place.
Yeah.
There will be onerous requirements. We're talking about how tough it is getting into the UK.
Mm.
The US will probably put some really strict testing regimes in, effectively to say to people like you, we know you really want to come here. We're going to make it possible for you, but we're not going to make it easy for you. Mm. And then, of course, coming back in, it would be the same thing. But I would say that you can claim to have important caring duties.
Yeah.
And I would be keeping hopeful. But in terms of an actual holiday, I don't think that we'll all be rushing back to Florida on the 17th of March, May, even though, of course, I would love to be.
No, of course. I mean, I'm thinking more of a quick sort of hop across for the weekend type thing. You know?
Yeah. You need to quarantine when you came back. That's the problem.
That's why I can't do it at the moment. That's absolutely irritating the hell out of me. But Simon, as ever, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Great information from Simon Calder, travel writer at The Independent, of course. Travel guru, I would say, more likely. But the trouble is, right, it's all very well reading these stories about Greece opening up in May when nobody else is doing so. It's all very well saying, well, you can go to Greece, but you might not have to quarantine when you come back. We don't know that yet. Lots of people apparently are booking summer holidays. If you've done that, if you're one of them, I'd love to hear from you, because I don't know what has inspired you to do so, or what has indeed convinced you that by booking a summer holiday, you've got something to look forward to, but you might not actually be able to do it. You might not be able to go.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, let us, without further ado, go to Mr. Neil Oliver, archaeologist, TV presenter, who wrote a piece in the Sunday Times at the weekend in which he said, Scotland is making me sick and it's not COVID that's to blame. Neil, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, mate. Good to see you.
Yeah, things are going from bad to worse up there, aren't they? I mean, it's one thing. I mean, you said to me during the week that your kids or kids in Scotland have been wearing masks for quite a long time already. How's that working out?
Well, we've had, I think, you know, a lot of the media coverage tends to, you know, to focus on the announcements that are coming from, you know, from Boris Johnson and from the government in Westminster. And we've been walking a different road. And I would say that we've had a tighter lockdown for longer than, say, south of the border. And certainly I was interested in a lot of the debate that was going on, or the conversations that were going on about, you know, kids having to wear masks at school, because the senior kids in high school here, which, you know, takes in two of my kids, they've been wearing masks in class for months.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I suppose you'd have to ask individual kids how they feel about that and how inconvenienced they feel by it.
Right.
Sadly, I suppose, you know, for youngsters, the longer it goes on, the more it does become just something that they have, you know, learned to get used to.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that it's a good thing.
Right.
It's just, if it's something that's inflicted upon you, then I suppose you just find ways to...
Well, this is the trouble, isn't it? I mean, I've been talking to people in the last few days about the kind of supplicants that people suffer from now, where, you know, they ask, rather than saying, what the hell do you mean I can't go to Greece? They ask instead, oh, when will I be able to go on holiday? And you go, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, that's an interesting turning point, tipping point, where once upon a time we took we assumed that we were entitled to do things, anything in fact, unless there was a specific law that prohibited us from doing it.
Yeah.
And now it's flipped through 180 degrees. And now a lot of people are operating on the assumption that they're not allowed to do anything unless they ask an authority figure first and, you know, and get a chitty.
I know.
That they can show whoever asks.
And I suppose that's a natural kind of progression from months and months and months of just literally being forced into a situation. But that's why it's interesting what you say about mask wearing, because, I mean, I got a couple of tweets yesterday from people. One was a nurse who said, well, I wear a mask all day, every day, and sometimes I forget to take it off when I get into the car because I was so used to wearing it. Another woman said, my granddaughter goes to school in Dubai and they've been wearing masks forever and nobody thinks anything of it. Well, I'm sorry. I do not want my children to wear a mask in school every single hour of every single day. I don't think it's good for them.
No, I mean, you can make kids do anything. That's a fact. I mean, you know, we used to have six-year-olds in factories. Yeah. You know, we used to have kids in the coal mines.
Those were the days.
Kids can be easily, you know, acculturated to almost anything you want them to do. But obviously, there'd be schools of thought about what was actually good for them. Mm. I don't think it's good for them. I mean, the idea that, of course, I mean, a nurse or people working in theatre, surgery, in those kind of situations, of course they're wearing masks all day. I would too if I had that job.
Right.
But, you know, I don't wear a welder's mask all day because I'm not a welder.
Right.
You know, that there's a place for these things, and I don't think the place for it. Kids, what worries me as much, if not more, is I'm already hearing we've talked about it before. They're talking about getting the kids back into school and having cancelling summer holidays, and you know, and having, you know, sort of pressuring them through to catch up, as though it was their fault that they've fallen behind, which it isn't. And for me, the absolute 24-carat gold priority is that when the children go back to school, they go back into normal school.
Yes.
That would be my objective,
right,
where they're not worried about masks. They're not worried about, you know, tests and things getting stuck up their nose or down their throats to take swabs. They're just, you get them back into school and you reacquaint them with normality.
Yes.
You don't get them back in, bums on seats, and then say, right, we've now got to catch up for the year you missed. The kids are desperately stressed, worried about all sorts of things, and they are worried about their educations and their futures. And the last thing they need is to go back into a school environment where they're told, right, the race is on and it's catch up now or fail.
Well, that's
right. Wrong.
Well, that is wrong. And also, I mean, I've been talking to a lot of parents over the last sort of 24 hours or so, and they're saying to me, well, either it's safe to go back to school or it's not. And if it's safe to go back to school, why do you need a mask? Why do you need to be tested? Why do you need a vaccine?
Well, I get shouted at for saying this, but I don't see anything changing much anytime soon. Based on what has happened before, I think if the policy is to maintain mass testing, then if and when we open up and whatever, open schools, open shops, open pubs, open theatres, open, if they keep testing, the number will go back up again. And they'll have all the justification, in inverted commas, that they've ever required to lock down again.
Right.
I think the idea that this is the last lockdown is a fantasy. I really do. And I can also, you can see the way in which everything about climate change, which had sort of gone into abeyance. Mm. We weren't hearing so much about that for a year.
Yeah.
And it's back again. And I could easily see circumstances in which there's a neat sort of segue, a sort of sleight of hand, where the restrictions that have been in place to control COVID could conveniently become restrictions that would bring down the amount of carbon emissions.
Oh, yeah.
Cars are parked on the pavement.
Absolutely.
People aren't going anywhere. And they might well say, well, this used to be about COVID, but hey, now that we've all learned to not go anywhere, not travel anywhere, stay in our houses, that could quite easily be, by a sleight of hand, that could become, and now it's about carbon emissions.
Yeah. Because it's based on the same nonsense of modelling and, you know, projection and, you know, what the future truth will be rather than what the actual current truth is. And you can very easily see, I would imagine, Neil, people sort of shaking their fist at you for driving down the road in a car instead of being on a bike.
Yeah, there is no way, short of putting, you know, short of military curfews and whatever, and, you know, and people being shot on sight, there is no way that a government, it can maintain control of people. The only way it works, short of that kind of, you know, Eastern Bloc coercion, is if people police each other.
Right.
And to some extent, that's already been achieved. Mm. You know, you need neighbour watching neighbour, and you need people controlled by the censure of their peers, so that you know things like smoking, you know, that didn't diminish in the way that it has because of laws. It became something that you were pariah.
Yeah.
If you were smoking in an office or smoking in a shop.
Yeah, that people assumed that if you were still smoking, despite all of the warnings about it, that you must be an idiot. Effectively.
So that's how that's done. Yeah. You know, it's we police societies are trained to and molded into policing each other, and that much has already been achieved.
Yes, exactly right. Let's talk a bit about what the SNP are up to, because Nicola Sturgeon yesterday refusing to go further than Boris Johnson, refusing to lift the sanctions which she's put into place on the grounds that, it's not time. And as you say, she's not ready to do it yet. But quite extraordinary what's going on there, isn't it? I mean, you wrote at the weekend that, you know, for the last 14 years, the SNP has been in charge of Scotland, effectively. And they're ruining it.
Yeah, the SNP have been in power for too long. I think that's, 14 years. You know, presumably, I can't even remember, but I'm quite sure when the SNP got into a position of power, they were in saying, right, bear with us for a little while and we'll make Scotland a better place. I mean, that's what political parties, that's what governments trade on. You know, we will now improve the lot of the many.
Yeah.
And if you can't, if after 14 years all the evidence shows that you've made everything worse, then you can't do it and you've been in place for too long. And everything has gone down, education, health, the hospitals that can't open. You know, 100 years ago, one in every a tenth of the world's shipping was built on the Clyde. Now we can't build a couple of ferries. They're rusting rusting hulks on the Clyde.
Yeah.
The bridge that has to close because if it's icy, blocks of ice could wreck cars.
Right.
All sorts of scandals about individual SNPs. You know, the person who is being groomed effectively as the First Minister's successor, Mackay, I mean, he had to step away because he had been sending hundreds of tweets to a schoolboy, calling him cute. So he had to step away. There are legion the scandalous and tawdry allegations about one SNP MSP after another are too many to mention. They've just been there for too long. It's a fatigue that sets in, an inertia that sets in. They've had long enough to make Scotland a better place, and by most metrics, they've made Scotland a worse place.
Right.
And they've made it a much
less tolerant place. I mean, I lived in Scotland up until about 2008, I think I left. And up until then, devolution was actually seeming like quite a good idea. You know, Jack McConnell was the first minister. He's a decent guy. I got to know him quite well. He doesn't agree with me about everything, and he banned smoking when I still smoked, which I constantly blame him for. But it did make me give up in the end. But, you know, devolution was working somehow. But now it seems like a beast that's kind of eating itself.
Well, I would say that the what they call the Salmond Inquiry has been a stress test for the devolution settlement and the Assembly, the Parliament in Scotland. And it's breaking under that stress test. You know, that we don't have a second chamber, a House of Lords, as it were, to scrutinise what's going on. And the idea was always that they would have these very strong independent committees that would have the necessary powers, the teeth, to scrutinise and to make sure that everything was above board. And these committees were trumpeted as going to be, you know, the most open and, you know, and empowered, far-reaching, you know, bodies. And that was how that was all going to be managed. Now, the proof of that would have been in the pudding of the Salmond Inquiry.
And yes.
I would just invite anyone south of the border to consider what would be happening if this situation was unfolding in Westminster.
Mm.
You know, hypothetically, you know, if you had a sitting Tory prime minister who was being having allegations made about him by a former Tory prime minister, who was saying that, you know, that he or she had been accused of all sorts of sexual wrongs, that he'd been cleared of that in court, but was alleging that there had been a conspiracy that even the present prime minister had been a part of to ruin that person's life and to have them sent to jail for the rest of their lives. Now, that would have been, the media would be over that like a cheap suit.
Oh, yeah.
they'd be watching every move of it, and it would be dominating every broadcast round the clock. And now we've got a situation where the Crown Office in Scotland, which is the equivalent of the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service in England, is now meddling in the an inquiry, a public inquiry that's being carried out by
Parliament.
That is wrong. That is demonstrably wrong.
Yeah, I mean, their investigation or their interruption, if you like, of this committee hearing yesterday seemed bizarre, because I didn't, one, understand what their reasoning was, because the information they're seeking to block is already out there in the public domain, has already been published in The Spectator, has already been talked about quite substantially in various forms of the media. And yet here they are attempting to kind of stop it from being discussed at one single committee, which has caused Alex Salmond to once again reverse his decision to go before them. It seems ludicrous.
I mean, again, I would invite anyone to imagine what the reaction would be in public and in the media if an inquiry in Westminster, if a public inquiry in Westminster was being interfered with by the CPS.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
I don't even think the CPS could do such a thing. I really don't think they have that sort of power, and neither should the Crown Office have that sort of power. But clearly they were presumably instructed by the First Minister to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. It is definitely becoming so. It's of by such, legally speaking, it's now of such Byzantine complexity that it's getting into territory where you'd need a legal mind or a legal qualification really to properly to follow what's going on. Mm. What I feel and what I know a lot of other people around me feel is that Scotland deserves better than this. If this is where devolution, if the nature of the devolution settlement has given us this, then this is not good enough.
No.
And the people of Scotland deserve better than this. I don't see any way in which you can deny that. Mm. A lot of it has to do with the way how it looks and the way it's being perceived. Now, you know, we've got a First Minister here who is more than happy to stand up and say that she believes that in being scrutinised, in being open, in being honest, but the conduct of her conduct and that of the SNP and this SNP-dominated committee, so that the SNP is scrutinising itself, I mean, how that is supposed to work, I don't know. It doesn't look good. And there's a growing number of people that feel from within Scotland that it just feels like McMafia.
Yeah.
You know, it feels more like a crime family than anything else.
It does.
You know, because, and that is how it looks.
And any kind of dissent is treated as malfeasance, almost. It's not treated as it should be. It's not taken on board. It's not kind of discussed. You are basically the enemy of the state if you've got something to say which you disagree with something the SNP are doing. I mean, you mentioned in your piece that Willie Rennie, the head of the Lib Dems, who we had on the show actually on Monday, has basically castigated the education system in Scotland, which used to be world class, and said it's not fit for purpose.
That is a genuine heartbreaker for a lot of people in Scotland. Mm. You know, it might be hard to... You know, I don't know, to sort of to empathise with the extent to which Scottish people were so proud of the education that was freely available to one and all.
Right.
You know, we used to, my parents, when I was growing up, it was celebrated. You know, it was shouted from the highest hills, the quality of the education that was available here, and the idea of the lad of Perts, you know, the boy or the girl from the most modest background, could, through the education that was freely available, achieve the highest office, go anywhere in the world, go and succeed there. That's what we told each other, and that's what we told ourselves, and fundamentally it was true.
Yeah, but also it was born out by the number of Scottish people in government in Britain, as a general rule, at the top of professions, at the top of companies. I mean, it was a very proud country, Scotland, because it produced these very smart people.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't subscribe to, you know, exceptionalism and claiming some kind of honour because a set of, you know, coincidences meant that you were born at a set of coordinates.
Yeah.
You know, but it was definitely the case that you knew that as someone who had been raised in Scotland and that you had gone to school in Scotland, that it was very much your own fault if you hadn't been able to grasp that and yes. take advantage of it and do whatever you wanted. Mm. It was low-hanging fruit. And I mean, education is the building block of everything for people coming up. And it was brilliant. And, you know, and Scotland was a fantastic place to go to school.
Yeah.
Any school in Scotland, right. You know, they were turning in results that were on league tables, you know, that held their heads up high in the wider world. Right. Scotland's had to take itself off those league tables.
Of course it has.
Because it's too embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, where we were a sort of a Man United or a Rangers, mm. you know, we're Accrington Stanley now, and you know, we're
well, you know, my dad. I mentioned my dad many times to you, but he had this great phrase, which I've no doubt I will get into trouble for repeating. But he used to say, "There's no such thing as the average Englishman; they're all below average." And you know, I used to find that very amusing. I used to say it to people as well. I used to wind them up no end. But the Scots had the ability to be able to defend that sort of position because they were very well educated. And as you say, yeah. I mean, now the Scots are a kind of inward-looking, tiny-minded race of people who don't want anyone coming in from the outside. And Nicola Sturgeon's kind of policy about keeping people away is just feeding into that.
Let me just qualify that there. I mean, the kind of Scottish person that still exists, and there's plenty of us, we might even be the majority, we are as horrified by that persona
yes.
as you are,
yes.
as anybody is. Mm. You know, the Scots that I mix with are the Scots that have always been here.
Yes.
They are decent, fantastic sense of humour, self-deprecating, also proud, mm. a wonderful culture,
yeah.
welcoming. You know, it's the legend that was the Scottish personality. Well, it still exists. Yeah. And people of that ilk are as horrified by the kind of, you know, Ian Blackford representation
yeah.
of Scottishness that is out there on stage. That is not Scotland. That no. is the SNP. Mm. And that's a different animal.
Yes. No, I totally get that. And I think a lot of people do. But equally, it's damaging the Scottish kind of image because people in England now say, well, I'll tell you what, if you want to have a referendum on Scottish independence, give it to us in England and they'll be gone in, you know, quicker than you can say, you know, hogmanay.
I hear the same thing. And I can understand why if you're bombarded with that representation of Scotland all the time, that SNP representation of Scotland, then I'm sure you would feel like that.
Yeah.
But the Scot, as I understand, the Scot is still here. You know, and we just don't get the microphone or the stage. Mm. And the devolution settlement, as I say, has been stress tested over and over again, most recently and most pertinently and most revealingly by this so-called inquiry. And it's not fit for purpose. And I'll say it every opportunity, every chance I get. Scotland is better than this and deserves better than this.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Neil, we're out of time, unfortunately, but fascinating stuff. And I mean, at some point or other, Alex Salmond will presumably appear before this committee. And at some point or other, he will be able to say what he wants to say. Neil Oliver, thank you very much indeed. Archaeologist, TV presenter, man of the people, a man who talks an awful lot of common sense and also talks for the whole of Scotland. When you know people from Scotland, and you, as I do, you know that they are not like Nicola Sturgeon. They are not the kind of inward-looking, you know, frightened, timorous beasties, as Robbie Burns would say, who don't want any visitors from England, who don't want any visitors from abroad, who don't want any visitors to come to Scotland because they might spread the virus. Absolute and utter claptrap. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Prime Minister's questions, of course, coming up at midday with Charlotte Ivers. We'll be covering it in our own inimitable way here at Talk Radio with a lot of a flash bang and some great special effects, of course, as well. Before we talk to Emma Webb, commentator, about the BBC and their latest blunder, let me just read you this from Scott in Southampton. He's texted texted in to 87222. He says, it's not just the politicians and the school face mask rules which lack all common sense. I'd like to ask Mike Graham if he can, live on air, declare my support bubble, Samantha from Portsmouth, deserves a place on Plank of the Week for giving me COVID. She had been working with a colleague who had flu-like symptoms and was then not only stupid enough not to realise it could be COVID, thought that even if it was the flu, it would be all right to bring it to my flat, and for not telling me about her colleague's illness until after she'd already spent half the evening in bed with me. I'm happy to talk live on air about this bizarre state of affairs and how people's lack of common sense is actually giving the government an excuse to keep us locked up forever. Indeed, it would be a peaceful way to get my own back. That's brilliant, Scott. Listen, I'm terribly sorry that your girlfriend has given you COVID. She ought to have known better. Maybe you need to get a new girlfriend, Scott. I mean, I don't know. You know what the number is, of course, 0344 499 1000, if you want to have your voice heard about how dreadful she is and what an idiot she is. But listen, there's plenty of idiocy out there. Some of it is being encountered at the BBC. Let's talk to Emma Webb. Emma, very good morning to you.
Hi, Mike.
I hope you're surviving the COVID pandemic. I don't know if you've actually had it, have you?
I don't think so.
No, that's good. I'm very glad to hear it. Now, there was a story that ran a month or so ago from, I think it was Guido who first put it out. The BBC was investigating the possibility of trying to teach people how to drink water properly. And it was roundly ridiculed. The BBC, I think, even denied that it was going on. But they found out, according to a Freedom of Information request, that actually not only was it true, but about 30 people at the BBC took part in some kind of ridiculous seminar teaching them how to drink water.
It's hilarious, isn't it? Mm. I hope that the 30 who took the course did it out of a sort of curiosity to find out how could you teach somebody how to drink water for an entire hour? I would love to know what the concept.
I mean, I've got a glass of water here. I'm pretty sure I can manage to drink it without actually needing any sort of instruction of any kind.
Maybe you might need to give listeners some directions on how to gulp it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? And I think some of the people at the BBC insiders were initially reported as having found it quite funny.
Yeah.
So obviously the BBC staff aren't so far gone that they thought that this was something that they actually needed. But it's interesting because the BBC, I've actually, out of a sort of morbid curiosity for my sins, been watching a lot of BBC recently, particularly the News and the One Show. Not to knock Blue Peter, because it was great when I was 8 years old, but the whole of the BBC's content output has turned into this kind of paternalistic, infantilizing children's program.
Yeah.
So it's hardly surprising that they feel that they have to teach their own staff, presumably people who should be the absolute top of journalism, just to do simple things like staying fit at home, and how to drink water.
Yeah.
I think the other courses they were offering was how to balance work and childcare. So it's hardly surprising that they feel that they need to do this when they're
It is extraordinary, isn't it? And also, I mean, whenever I see the One Show, which is usually by accident because I've left something else on, it seems to be just a sort of general sort of plug for everything else that's on the BBC. You know, oh, look, here's an interview with somebody who's in a show that the BBC are putting on tomorrow. Or here's somebody who's in a movie that the BBC are putting out. Or here's somebody who's in a series that the BBC are putting out. All they seem to do is plug their own show all the time.
Yeah, it seems like a kind of happy clappy propaganda, particularly over all of the COVID coverage. Because the thing that's really been irking me, and the reason why I've been keeping an eye on it, is because their coverage of any lockdown skeptic position, any criticism of government policy, is either non-existent or it's just completely dehumanising of the other side, as if it's totally beyond the pale.
Right.
And some of the stories that they've been airing, lots of things about lockdown romances, and just generally it has the tone of a "here's one I made earlier" children's presenter. So I can only imagine that the content of that water drinking course must have really been something to experience.
Oh, I know. And also, you know, I watched ITN News for the first time in a while last night, and I was quite staggered at the end when they said, as their kind of, you know, sign off, stay safe, stay home. I'm like, sorry, what's it got to do with you, what I'm doing? You know, this is the ITN newsreader telling me to stay home. Well, I'm not going to stay home, thanks very much indeed. I'm going out, actually. And in fact, after it finished, I went out just for the hell of it.
it drives people to alternative sources of media, doesn't it? Inevitably, because all of the main channels just seem to be an arm of government propaganda.
Yeah, exactly.
Just everything is blindly supportive of the line, in the same way that there's no opposition in Parliament really either to any of the policies over COVID.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're going to see shortly, I dare say, you know, Captain Hindsight popping up once more in his blue suit with his coiffed hair, Sir Keir Starmer, stammering around about how the government are doing exactly the right thing, but they should have done it before and they should have done it earlier. But he totally agrees with everything they're doing. I mean, it's a very bizarre world we're living in politically, isn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't it be wonderful if employers could treat their staff as if they were, you know, actually adults, and that the broadcasters could assume, as talk radio does, that its listeners are fully functioning adults.
Yes, who capable of making up their own minds.
Yeah, and the information that you give them isn't somehow a danger to them, or is it going to harm them emotionally if you expose them to views that are not perfectly flush with the government line.
Right. But there is this kind of outbreak of whatever the opposite of common sense is. I'm not quite sure if we should invent a name for it, but I don't know if you saw the story that was around yesterday. They've picked it up in the Daily Star today about Coca-Cola, who basically have told their staff that they need training to make them feel less white. They need them to be less oppressive, less arrogant, and less ignorant, as if all of those things are commensurate with being white.
It's horrendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
We do need a term. I think you're right there. We do need a term to describe this. It's a sort of insipid infantilization of not just adults, but our entire culture just seems to become one-dimensional and shallow.
Right.
And I mean, that goes without saying, the fact that clearly that Coca-Cola training course on how to be less white is evidently racist and just completely atrocious. I think it may have even been, I may be wrong here, but it may have even been a Robin DiAngelo training course, the lady who wrote White Privilege. I'm not sure if that's
it could well
case,
be but, yeah
in any case, it's part of the same general vein. And it's remarkable that we're in a position where our broadcasting and our companies and corporations are so rotten that these sorts of things can even go ahead and happen.
Well, this is it. And also, I've always found, Emma, I don't know about you, but when you go right into it and you sort of drill down into this kind of white privilege argument, there's always somebody at the other end of it making money. And if it's Robin DiAngelo because she's being hired by companies to be consulted on this and paid bucket loads of money in order to sort of, you know, cleanse the organisation of white supremacists, you know, there's always somebody making a profit out of it. You know, whether it's all the way down to David Icke and his reptilian royal family, or all the way up to Robin DiAngelo, it's all cobblers and they're all getting rich on it.
Yeah, all aboard the gravy train.
Yeah.
It's good grift if you can get on it. I think people like Robin DiAngelo are earning thousands of pounds per training
minute,
session.
Probably, yeah.
Just for telling people that they're white and awful and guilty and spreading what is really a kind of we refer to it as woke in an almost dismissive sense, but it's a sort of pernicious new almost semi-religious ideology that they're spreading, and they're getting paid an awful lot to do so.
It's very dangerous, it seems to me. And also, people are being appointed in roles, as we well know, from the NHS to the BBC, you know, diversity coordinator, you know, somebody brought in to make sure that there's enough, you know, different people being involved and employed by the company. I mean, it's a shocking business, really.
Yeah, and those roles all pay more money than most normal people could even dream of.
Yeah.
£60,000 or £70,000 upwards for some of those roles, which is, I think, the same amount as MPs earn, which is completely absurd.
Yeah.
And presumably this is just to sort of saturate the organisations or the companies as much as possible in this new ideology.
And we pointed out yesterday Merseyside Police and that ridiculous poster campaign they launched, which they then had to apologise for, where they said basically giving offence was indeed a crime. Making people offended was a crime, when in fact it clearly wasn't a crime, and they got it completely. So you'd think the police would actually know what a crime was instead of inventing new ones.
Yeah, they had to come out and apologise to tell people that actually the thing that they had put on that poster, the absolute opposite is true, and being offensive isn't at all an offence, but that their intentions were well placed. Right. And so in their apology, they actually reminded the public that it is a that hate crime is an offence, and it is still an offence to, presumably what they're trying to imply there is that certain types of speech are offensive and an offence. So it was a bit of a mealy-mouthed apology, really.
I know. Unbelievable.
There's nothing quite like seeing a police force standing in front of a LGBT flag.
Rainbow.
With that kind of messaging on it, thinking that that isn't going to absolutely tank in public.
I know. I know. Well, thank goodness there are people like you and I, Emma, around who will consistently rail against it and hopefully stop it eventually from becoming too pernicious so that we all have to succumb to it. Emma Webb, commentator, talking to us there about an awful lot of common sense. Maybe somebody can come up with a word for what common sense and the opposite of common sense actually is.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
It is, of course, time now, after the news at 12:30, to do a little bit of homeschooling. People back to school this week after a bit of half-term action, where people were told that they didn't really have to do any homework to any great extent, or any home learning. March the 8th is the date we're told that kids are going back to school. We've got a post out there on Twitter today. Will you agree to making your child wear a mask all day in school? A massive number of you, 88%, say absolutely not. That's nearly 5,000 people that have voted in that, which would suggest that the YouGov poll, which has the exact opposite result, would appear to be not particularly correct, would it? Let's talk to Dr. Laura Smith, presidential historian at Richmond, the American International University in London. Dr. Laura, very good afternoon to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Not at all. Now, we occasionally go into areas where perhaps other people don't go. Today, we're going to look at Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was the longest serving president of the United States ever. Apparently, he had four terms, which is sort of unheard of, isn't it?
Absolutely. He was unprecedented in terms of running for a third term, while actually being elected for a third term. And it was really World War II that made that possible.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you carry on.
Yeah, so he died during his fourth term. He died just after Yalta in 1945. But he really set the stage for global politics as we know it today, America as a superpower, and also domestic politics and the role of the presidency and the federal government in our lives.
Yes, because he's famous for the New Deal, which I guess we'll get onto in a little while. But, I mean, it's hard to imagine, I suppose, having an election in the middle of a war. But I guess in 1940, America wasn't quite in the war, really. And by 1944, I suppose they were considering it to be near the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I mean, in terms of elections during war, 1864 and Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War takes the cake for that.
Right.
But for FDR, he had a lot of foresight in thinking that America would almost inevitably become entangled and involved in World War II. Mm. And he had a lot of work to push against these isolationists that are so often forgotten when you think about American society today. But America First had a long history, especially in the interwar years.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's a phrase you hear a lot now, America First. But in fact, you don't really think of going back quite as far as that to find it. I mean, Britain was similar, wasn't it? There were quite a few people in this country who were not keen on getting involved in a fight against Hitler.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Isolationism is not just renowned in the States. It has a long global history. And obviously, these things are interconnected. And we know FDR and Churchill, we think of the special relationship. And it's just those sort of cultural similarities and political ideologies that right. share a transatlantic partnership.
And did he have the same vice president throughout the four terms, or did that sort of chop and change?
It did chop and change. So Truman, when he took over after FDR's death, he didn't know about the atomic weapons. He didn't know about that capability had been built. And so he had to make that decision, catching up on the top secret intelligence at the time.
Right. Interesting. Tell us about the New Deal, because that kind of set the stage, really, did it not, for America's recovery from the war, not just the recovery from the war, but the whole kind of building of the infrastructure of the country.
Yeah, it's still a matter of debate, really, just how much the New Deal helped in terms of economic recovery from the Great Depression, because a lot of scholars would argue that it was really World War II that had the greatest impact in recovery for the economy. It was that industrial buildup, the arms buildup, etc. But it was certainly a very different approach from Hoover, who got kicked out of office by FDR in 1932. And FDR had this optimism that really resonated with people. He got elected on this campaign of happy days are here again. And it's sort of quite Reagan-esque, really, this great communication, this idea of coming into office, even though, you know, there's an economic anxiety, great economic pain being felt. And he uses this 100 days, this momentum, to get a lot of bills passed, including things that are relied on today. So it's going back to this idea of the role of federal government in Americans' lives, having that safety net, Social Security. But he didn't get everything he wanted passed. And that's really important to remember as well. Things like healthcare, it's still an issue in American politics. It is still a very difficult, controversial thing, this concept of universal healthcare. But it was something that he would have liked to have gotten passed.
Yes, and you mentioned he's a bit sort of Reagan-esque. Is that the president that you would maybe so closely associate him with, if you were to convince people that, you know, this was the kind of president he was? Was he like Reagan?
Certainly not in ideology, but in terms of communication, absolutely. If you think of presidents who are renowned as, obviously, we think of Reagan, the great communicator. We also think of Kennedy. We also think of Barack Obama.
Yeah.
These are presidents who really have that gift and are able to use political rhetoric to a great advantage.
Okay. And there was an interesting sort of development, was there not? Because he had a disability which nobody really knew about.
Absolutely. So what's really interesting, if anyone has seen The Post, the film The Post with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, it really talks about this idea of the press being the president's friend.
Yeah.
And this changed during the Vietnam and definitely with Watergate. That was the real shift between the relationship between the president and the press. But during FDR's time, the press, obviously being around him, they knew that he was wheelchair bound. And there were photographs of him being helped and lifted out of a car. But for purposes of morale, they decided not to share this with the American public. And we think today about candidates having to share all of their details, you know, medical history, traditionally speaking anyway, and taxes and things like that. So this was a very different relationship. And he had been crippled by polio at the age of 39. And he actually designed the wheelchair that he used himself. Mm. And he had a car that he could operate by his hands. And so it was all meant to make it look like he was a fully able-bodied man, not to have anyone question him, or it hurt America's sort of image, if you like, if he looked enfeebled in any way.
Right. It's interesting, isn't it? I read a great book once, I can't remember the name of it, by William Safire, who was once a speechwriter for Nixon. And he wrote this novel about a president who went blind while he was in office and all the measures that they took to try and prevent that from becoming known in public, because he was thought that if they shared the fact that he was blind, he would suddenly lose all of his authority. And it's interesting that even, I suppose, now you see presidential debates around people's health. And remember, Hillary Clinton was accused of not being very well by Trump. And, you know, it's I don't think there's any other country where that becomes such a big deal.
You certainly could make that argument. I mean, Wilson as well. He wasn't very well. He had a stroke. Mm. He was really sort of incapacitated. It was the first lady who took on quite a bit of the administration side.
Right.
There's certainly, and of course, JFK, his back injury is another really good example. But it's something that in today's society with social media, I don't think you could really get away with.
No, I think that's probably right. And was it after FDR's time in his fourth term that they limited it now to two terms only?
Yes, that's exactly right. So that's when the amendment was passed, that it had to be two terms. And that was based on tradition and the precedent originally set by George Washington. Right. A lot of people, if they're talking about Washington's greatness, they will sort of hang that argument on the fact that he knew when to leave. And sort of, you know, the graceful gentleman knows when to leave.
Right. Yes, I think that could be levelled at one or two people in the modern age, could it not? Great to talk to you, Dr. Laura Smith. Thank you very much indeed. Presidential historian at Richmond, the American International University in London. FDR, an amazing character, a tremendous president, and an amazing historical figure for the United States of America in terms of what he did and how long he did it for. Four terms at 16 years in the White House, also creating what is now known as the New Deal, of course.
Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.